Blog Talk Radio.
Backed by popular demand is financial expert Lurie Davis with tips and strategies on creating wealth and building a secure future with or without your job. Lurie recently joined Carol's My Own Kitchen Cabinet leadership team, and he'll be a regular giving you advice, answering questions, and helping you design a stress-free financial future for peace of mind and long-term success. We'll also talk with Mass Vote Executive Director Cheryl Crawford and discuss the low voter turnout, about 31%, in this week's hot Boston mayoral primary. With such an important primary, why did so few eligible voters show up at the polls? And more importantly, how does this connect with other elections across the country with low voter turnouts? From creating personal wealth to voter advocacy, today's show will stretch you toward new courses of action. This is Carol Copeland Thomas, and you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. Hello, my friend. This is Carol Copeland Thomas. Thank you so much for listening either live in the chat room or if you are listening as an archive. This may be a show that you want to share with others because we're going to divulge some really important information as we're looking at your finances, looking at your future, and also the impact of low voter turnout here in Boston that took place on Tuesday, September 24th. You can always call the show at 646-727-2766. Dial in, listen. You can press 1, and that lets me know you want to ask a question, or you certainly can participate in our chat room. I know I have a lot of visitors who stop by, and I encourage you to sign up for Blog Talk Radio. It doesn't cost you anything, and then you can participate and ask questions directly in the chat room. Well, we have a packed show today, and what I want to do is to play the short 5-minute interview that I did with Cheryl Crawford. She's the executive director of Mass Vote. Very important information. They do not take sides when people are running for office, but they have a ton of information that they're always willing to share with you or anyone else. The website is massvote.org, and you can go there and get information about various policies or issues or the various candidates that are running for the elections around the state of Massachusetts. Cheryl Crawford is going to relate and respond to my disgust, and I'm really pretty disgusted with Boston voters not coming out for such an important election with 12 viable candidates and a total of 61 candidates, including the city council race as well. So here's Cheryl, and she will give her insights on what happened on Tuesday. Well, I'm delighted to talk with a very hard-working woman who is the executive director of one of the most important watchdog organizations we have in the state, Mass Vote. We're talking to Cheryl Crawford. Hello, Cheryl. Thanks so much for joining us on the air.
Oh, thank you for having me, Carol. It's a pleasure.
Well, I hope you're getting some rest. I know that I've just been agitated since the primary on Tuesday, and most importantly, absolutely mortified by the low turnout, with 31% of the electorate coming out to vote in Boston to cast their election, their vote for our mayor and also the city councilors. What are your thoughts? What's your reaction about this horrifically low number?
Well, I'm with you, Carol. I am finally calming down. I was just really angry. I found myself just really angry at the end of the night at the turnout. You know, so many organizations are working so hard to turn out the vote, grassroots, nonprofit organizations. But we also had 61 people on the ballot. I am puzzled. Like, you have 61 people on the ballot, 12 mayoral candidates, 19 at large, and several within each district. I thought that if they just turned out that this was going to be the largest race, you know, in terms of turnout in a long, long time. But that wasn't the case. That wasn't the case.
You're out there all the time. You're beating the bushes, knocking on doors, working with your staff members, collaborating with other organizations like Mass Vote. What are you hearing? What are people saying as to reasons why they're not voting?
So some of them are just absolutely ridiculous, some of the reasons. Other things like I was confused. The ballot was so crowded. I didn't know who to vote for. We heard things of that nature. Then on the other side, I'm hearing people saying, you know, I just voted. You know, how many elections are we going to have this year? Mm-hmm. You and I both know how important it is, no matter how many elections they have, that you must go out and vote, right?
Exactly.
Just vote
right.
every time. But, you know, right. people, for different reasons. I mean, it was a beautiful day. I'm like, really? You know? So
I post on my YouTube page a commentary by John Keller, who is a political analyst on CBS Boston, and he has said exactly what I have said, what you said. He predicted, he said, if the voter turnout is under 35% or so, it's pathetic, and it's a grave concern that he has. So the comments that he has made, we're all making, in terms of not only the fact that people aren't bothering to come out, but also the implications and the fact you're talking about 61 candidates, 12 mayoral candidates, and then a number of city councilors who were running either as incumbents or those who were challenging their position. I mean, the choices are endless. And I think people need to really look at other countries where it is typical to have a number of people on the ballot, a number, whether what office you're running for. Yet in so many other countries, the voter turnout is so much higher. So I'm pretty adamant and probably going to become more militant in my rhetoric, in my conversation with people, because they don't understand how they're usurping their power. So, Cheryl, what do you think is the solution? What do we need to do? You certainly, as a pioneer, will continue to move forward. What are your thoughts about that?
I just know that we have to circle the wagons and figure this thing out. We're banging our head up against the wall. Like, what? There's issues in our community. What part of this are you not plugging into? The people, the issues, how much more prevalent do these issues have to become for you to pay attention? The violence that's going on in the street, the lack of jobs, the health disparities, the education system, right? Here's an opportunity for you to really take a look at the candidates that are going to be controlling how we change the system, our education system, right? Why would you not plug in? Do you have children? We're just trying to figure it out and having these conversations. And that will be the real conversation in a lot of our debrief meetings that are coming up over the next week or so. I mean, I had to give people a break just so that they could take a breath and really come out of the shock that only 30.7% came out. 2009, two candidates on the ballot, Menino and Flaherty, 23.12% came out.
Hmm.
This year, 30.7 with 12 candidates. So I'm not sure. Is it voter fatigue? Do we have to take a look at our laws and figure out how do we handle these special elections? Can we take a look at our laws and figure out how we cannot have an election every single year? When do the legislators get to do their work? If you're running and you're if there's an election every other year, you get installed. You work a little bit, and then you're in campaign mode because you're trying to keep your job, right? Maybe we should take a look at having the elections once every 4 years. I don't know.
Well, lots of good questions. You certainly have put them out there. Not sure what the answer is, and it's a combination of looking at reframing from a policy perspective in terms of the frequency of voting, but also I'm going to push back and say we have got to somehow wake up the electorate to impress upon them the importance of their vote. Not only impacting the community and the society, but ultimately impacting their families and their paychecks and their own future. Cheryl Crawford, thank you so much for being a guest on my program. Please check out massvote.org, massvote.org. They always have great information on that website. They're doing yeoman's jobs of things around the greater Boston and the Massachusetts area, and we will definitely have you back on again, Cheryl. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carol. Appreciate being here today.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, it's important material to really follow. And again, it may be dry and boring to some people, but when you look at some of the policies that we are living under, the regulations, wherever you happen to live in this country or elsewhere, it all deals with voting. It all deals with who's in office and who is ultimately creating the laws that we are actually living under, whether you're living in the city of Boston or whether you're living in Bangkok, Thailand. Wherever you happen to be voting is important. Historic election here in Boston, 1983, took place between the great race of Ray Flynn and Mel King. That primary, and there were other candidates running then, that was 30 years ago, 166,716 people roughly voted in that race. That's as of about 200,000 eligible voters during that time. It was about 80 to 83% voter turnout. That was very historic. Typically, the primaries since that point have been pretty low, and this obviously was fairly abysmal. Did some research, and even in some cities and towns, it's uncommon, it's not uncommon, for mayors to be elected on single-digit percentages, 7%, 8% of the people coming out bothering to vote. So I'll be doing more shows on this going forward. I will definitely have more information about this on my websites, tellcarol.com and mssconnect.com, really important issues. Before we bring our special guest on today, Lurie Davis, we're going to take a little message break and talk about my upcoming November 7th multicultural conference. Stay tuned.
Network. Meet movers and shakers and take your plan of action to work the next day. That's what will happen when you attend the November 7th Multicultural Conference at UMass Boston. Co-hosted by Carol Copeland Thomas, the Multicultural Symposium Series, and the University of Massachusetts Boston Campus, this event is for anyone serious about global diversity, multiculturalism, inclusion, and leadership issues. If your job, community project, or anything has to do with making a difference by expanding your cultural network, register and attend the November 7th Multicultural Conference. A stellar set of speakers include television news anchor LaToya Edwards and Vice President of Global Inclusion Paul Francisco of State Street Corporation. Call us at 508-947-5755 or visit our website for registration information at www.mssconnect.com. We'll see you at the conference.
Well, I'm really excited about that conference. We'll talk to you more about that in the weeks to come. It's right around the corner. We hope that you will attend, if not in person, that you'll become a member of the Multicultural Symposium Series, and we'll tell you how you can participate going forward. Well, I'm excited now to bring my friend and colleague back on. He's been in the financial services field for many, many years, has a lot of great advice for us. I have some questions to ask. We've had some questions asked on my Facebook page and elsewhere. It's a pleasure to bring a Kitchen Cabinet Leadership Team member, Lurie Davis. Hi, Lurie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Carol. Thank you very much for having me, and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, you have seen an awful lot. You've seen recessions come and go. You've talked to probably countless people who want to dig in and start that nest egg. What's the hot trend right now in terms of how you're serving your customers or methodologies or things that we need to really be concerned about in terms of wealth creation, Lurie?
I think the good thing that I'm seeing right now, especially what happened with the major recession that we previously had, more and more people are now focused and getting their financial house in order. They're trying to get their emergency fund put away very quickly so that they could have their reserves saved up for emergency funds. So I always tell most of my clients to have anywhere from a 6 to 8 month worth of emergency savings put aside.
Gosh, that is so great advice. I've heard that for years. I haven't quite gotten there yet, but building my little nest egg as we speak, because I know how important it is. Do you find that people have that kind of reserve tucked away? How are people
managing to come up with 6 months or 8 months or even a year's worth of income to get them through rough times?
What I usually do with a lot of my clients, we focus, first of all, when I meet with clients, we do specific goals and objectives. Everything financially has to fit into the goals and objectives of a particular family because there's no two families alike out there. So whatever the goals and objectives are, we start to focus on that. We get rid of all the debt. There cannot be any debt on the plate. So we try to focus, get rid of credit cards, any store credits, we get rid of all the debt. After all the debt is gone, then we turn around and we focus on savings. We start to allocate within a budget a specific dollar amount to pay yourself first. So on the line item budget, when we do a budget and expense for a client, we will actually move that to the top of the budget so that the client know that you got to focus on self first. You got to pay yourself first, and then you start to save and make sure that you're putting that amount of money that you're going to need to put away for your emergency savings.
You know, I've heard pay yourself first for many years. Larry Davis, why is that important? And the average person would say, well, wait a minute, I would want to pay everything else, and then if there's something left, then I would pay myself first. And this particularly pertains to entrepreneurs and people, you know, where you have an income that is not a two-week version that normally people have who are working nine-to-five jobs. What are your thoughts and your take on that?
My take on that is that we work very hard. We go to our employers, our businesses, and we put in a substantial amount of hours on a, you know, daily, monthly, annual basis. And then after that, the paycheck that we receive, it all goes out. We, at the end of the day, we need to be able to look somewhere and see an account where there is actual money being accumulated for ourselves. I think that gives us a little pride. Just to know that I have this little amount of money set aside out there so that if anything ever did happen, I have some reserves set aside. So that confidence, I believe, it starts to allow you to build up. Psychologically, it also has a very positive impact on you when you know that I put myself on the top of this list because I consider myself to be very important. Financially, I think it's the best thing to do.
You mentioned also about getting rid of credit cards. Why is that good advice, particularly when we're living in a society where credit is paramount for some people to get from month to month?
My belief is that wealthy people do not use credit card in a negative way. We use credit cards in a positive way. That is that if we do put anything on a credit card, it is paid off 100%. In that month, the interest that gets accumulated on that credit card is money that we're throwing out the door. So if you carry a balance, it is a substantial amount of your wealth that you're giving over to somebody else.
Ooh, boy, you hit us right between the eyes. And how much should a person set aside for their personal savings, either based on what they're getting with their paycheck or if they are an entrepreneur based on what they're bringing in each month? What's a good rule of thumb for that, Larry?
The rule of thumb, mainly there's a couple of factors. One is what type of job that you have. There are certain jobs, let's say government jobs, where you have a very stable, dependable career job that you've been at for quite a long time, and most likely you're going to continue to be able to hold on to that job. That type of individual can probably put away about 3 months' worth of savings and be pretty good to go. The other person, like an entrepreneurial type of individual or business owner, needs to have at least 2 years worth of living expenses set aside so that they can allow the business, all of the money that comes in for the business, to mainly go towards the business and not to be used for personal financial expenses to run the home or for the family. So if you have your 2 years worth of reserve put aside, you're not going to be stressed, dependent on making money or the profits that come in for that business to be used towards your expenses for the home. You're going to put that money back into the business and grow that business. And then there are certain individuals, you know, in high income type of careers, type of jobs like doctors and lawyers. Those individuals need to have about 6 to 8 months worth of reserves set aside so that if they're let go from one job or from one corporation, they have a cushion already set aside so that that would allow them a period of time before they get another job.
You know, I'm listening to you and taking notes. It's such great advice, you know, and idealistically so, we'd love to always hit that mark. I'm also thinking about people who are in those high six-figure, seven-figure jobs, and increasingly, if they move from one job to the next, or they're in transition, or their department gets reorganized and they get reorganized outside of the business, and here they are having made $300,000 last year, and suddenly they're out of work and the prospects don't look as bright as they were, let's say, a year or so ago, and they just happen to be over 50 years old. Your advice definitely makes sense. Do you see people planning like that, or is this a norm, or what are you seeing out there, particularly with high-income people who may or may not be able to sustain this transition for a period of time if they're between jobs?
I would say that even in the high-income area, we have a lot of people who struggle. And the reason mainly has to do with the culture that we live in this society. You know, you have to have the Gucci and the Louis Vuittons, and so you have to go out and spend the money. There's a lot of doctors and lawyers, because of their profile, believe that they need to, you know, buy certain items or live a certain lifestyle. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. that lifestyle is very, very expensive. A lifestyle for them. So when I come across an individual like that, we have to really put the brakes on, because we really have to refocus psychologically as to what your goals and objectives are versus what the Joneses' goals and objectives are, or you seeing what the Joneses have. We have to refocus to look at exactly what it is that's on your plate, and what are the goals and objectives that you've always had for yourself and for your family. And then we have to try to get some lifestyle change to take place and some behavior change to take place. And it's not an easy thing to change lifestyle or change behavior, because we're creatures of habit. So we're always going to try to do what we've always done.
Mm-hmm.
So it requires behavior and lifestyle changes, which means you have to work probably with somebody like myself, a professional financial planner, who could really get in there, do the numbers so that you could really see the actual numbers and then get a better idea based on what you're doing and how those behaviors are impacting your goals and objectives financially.
Great advice, and certainly working with you is the order of the day. You can actually reach out to Lurie Davis at 781-595-0396. 781-595-0396. We'll give you his email address in just a few minutes. We had a question that came in on my Facebook page from Terry Ann Brown Watts, and she is asking, how do I pick a good mutual fund? Lurie?
Okay, sure. I would definitely say that you should never pick a good mutual fund out of a magazine. So any of the magazines that toot, let's say you get in the mail and it says these are the top growth funds for this cycle, and you run and you put your money in there, most likely it's going to end up being the worst performing fund after that cycle. One of the, I would think there are probably both.
Is that because the magazines, the article was written probably 3 to 6 months prior to the magazine hitting the newsstand? So by the time you get it, the article is already dated and the advice is not as current as it should be. Is that correct, Lurie?
Absolutely. That is absolutely correct. Based on the way that things happen in the stock market, it is very, very complicated. the way mm-hmm. that the stock market, it is not a simple market, even though people might paint it out to be. It is very complicated, and most people end up losing a lot of money, and they get turned off as a result of putting money into investments and then not seeing that balance increase for their investment. But it's how they go about it. There are four things that I believe that one should definitely focus on when they're thinking about picking a good mutual fund, because there are thousands. There are thousands out there. One is your goal and objectives. It has to fit into what your goal and objective is financially. It could, let's say, be retirement is the goal that you have. At age 50, your retirement and the goal that you have is going to be a little different of what mutual fund you place it into versus somebody who's 25 years old. Somebody who's 25 has more time, and therefore they can take more risks. Somebody at mm-hmm. 50 cannot take as much risk as that individual who is 25 years old because of that. So you're looking at how that fits into the goal and objective that you have. If it's a retirement and you need to accumulate, let's say for the next 10 years, you need to accumulate an additional $300,000. And where can you place that? Most likely you're going to be looking into the stock market and either at a growth or a growth in income mutual fund mm-hmm. as being the place to park that, because you have that 10-year period of time. The next thing is risk. What kind of a risk taker are you? Are you a low risk taker, a moderate risk taker, or are you a high risk taker? The next would be in terms of time horizon, that 10 years that we're talking about. If you have 10 years, yes, you can go into a growth fund. If you do not have 10 years, let's say you only have 3 years to go, you could not place that in a growth fund because of how these things fluctuate. This year it might be up. The next year it could be down 10 points. So it's going to fluctuate. Within a 10-year period, that's going to give you a reasonable period of time for that money to have grown for you. And the last item I would say is focus on the performance of the fund based on a long-term schedule. Don't look at 1 or 2 years performance record. Look at the longer-term performance record for the fund, at least 5 to 10 years.
So what you're saying, when you look at your goals and objectives and what level of risk are you willing to take and the time horizon and the performance, you need to do your homework. So it's not just reading that magazine that has the top picks of the month or whatever. You've got to do other research and dig deeper so that you're going to make the sound decisions that will be most beneficial for your portfolio. And very quickly, Lori, how can you advise young professionals like my daughter and son-in-law with young children who will be entering the college market, let's say, in 10 to 15 years? Any advice for that? For that group?
Yes, absolutely. I believe that they have to get started. There are two programs that are out there for young children, for parents to participate in. One is an IRA. It's the called the Coverdell, Coverdell IRA. That allows the parents to put away about $2,000 on an annual basis into an account. Next is the 529 program. There are many, many different 529 programs that the mutual fund companies each have. And then depending on which mutual fund company you go to, they've registered that in a particular state. So it's state's program that sponsors the 529 program. And then there are certain tax issues that might come into play depending on if you take a program that's outside of your state. But a 529 would be the other program at a mutual fund company, probably is the best place to establish one of those. And that program allows one to put away thousands of dollars into an education program. Some of those programs are specific target dated, where they must have it targeted based on the date that the child is going to go to college. But those would be the main two programs. But, yes, they must get started. Because time is a factor.
Great, great. Lurie Davis, he's part of our leader, our Kitchen Cabinet leadership team. He will be back with us in the weeks to come. Send your questions in to us. You can also email Lurie at ldwm@comcast.net and talk with him directly. Lurie Davis, thank you so much for being my guest today. We hope that you will have a great week or weekend. Come back and join us. We won't be on the air next week, but in 2 weeks we'll be back with you. Enjoy everything. And empowerment begins when you believe in yourself. Take it easy.